You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Gene Turnower. Gene, it's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So the way the show starts is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live, the values you have aspired to enact in your life, the things you've done, the labels you wear? What do we need to know to start the conversation? Who are you?
My mother lived to be 102 years old. And the perennial question is, what do you do for a living?
Yeah.
I started off at Washington University as a lecturer in the English department and debate coach. And I left that to become an organizer for a corps in Missouri and Nebraska. This is 60, 61. And that probably is the most important experience of my life, of going into the town with academic credentials and being able to sit down with the white structure, a mayor and so on, and then go and meet with African-American leaders who wanted to set up a corps chapter in Kansas City, Kansas, Omaha, Nebraska, Independence, Des Moines, Iowa, so forth.
Right.
I did a couple years.
Sure. And I'm going to ask you, how old are you, just because you are a long-lived person?
Well, I was married to my wife in 61, and she was 18 and I was 21 then.
And
one of the things I want to focus at some point here, I don't want to
Sure. Realize
the conversation, but I have been a target all of my life of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, especially when I worked with Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to delve in. That's why I picked that one song of Dr. King's.
Sure.
Of Paul Rose's. Don't scandalize my name.
Right. So we're gonna cut to music because we're gonna play that song, and then
Okay. We
can talk about what that song means to you, and
Right. Get
a bit of a sense of your life and what you've learned. So. Our first song is Paul Robeson, Scandalize My Name.
I met my brother the other day, gave him my right hand, and just as soon as ever my back was turned, he scandalized my name. Now do you call that a brother? No. No, no, you call that a brother? No, no, scandalize my name. I met my sister the other day, gave her my right hand, and just as soon as ever my back was turned, she scandalize my name. Now do you call that a sister? No, no. You call that a sister? No, no. You call that a sister? No, no. Scandalize my name. I met my preacher the other day, gave him my right hand, and just as soon as ever my back was turned, he scandalized my name. Now do you call that religion? No, no. You call that religion? No, no. You call that religion? No, no.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Gene Turnower. So Gene, tell me about your experience as an organizer, why this song means something to you, and what you want us to take away from that time in your life.
Well, it's quite an abrupt departure from my earliest youth. I was raised at St. Teresa's Little Flower Catholic Dominican School in St. Louis. Dominican nuns taught me how to read, and I can't speak highly enough of their educational adeptness. And then I went to St. Louis University High School, Mass, and was a devout Our Lady of Sodality. And while at the high school, I joined a debate team. I was in the boxing team. I was a cross country runner, and I was a sharpshooter. I had a certificate from the NRA. So I was really your all-American kid. I used to give speeches on Americanism to the Lions Club and the Kiwanis. So it was a pretty straightforward, used to read Boy's Life, childhood. But then I began on my own. The Jesuits in their school subscribed to the Nation magazine, which back in the 50s was pretty avant-garde. They had a column there by a Spanish writer, Julio Alvarez del Valle, who was the last foreign minister of the Spanish Republic. And he had a tremendous influence on me of what the role of the Catholic Church was in supporting Franco and defeating the. So that began really to open my mind to different interpretations of history. Began subscribing to the Rationalist Annual I began moving further and further away from Catholicism. So by the time I graduated, my counselor, Father Duquesne, broke down in tears because he said he had failed me because I went to Washington U instead of St. Louis U, which was the Jesuit path.
Right.
But I said, that was a big episode.
So then you went to St. Louis University, I mean to Washington University.
Washington University.
But you also taught there.
Yeah, when I graduated, I was on a debate team at Washington U, and I brought in speakers. I had a discretionary budget to bring in. I brought I.F. Stone in to speak, who was a publisher of a magazine in the 50s. I really was not cut out for an academic career. Mm-hmm. When the opportunity came, I was involved with a sit-in at Santoro's restaurant in 1958, an Italian restaurant on the edge of campus, which wouldn't serve minorities. And I got involved with CORE at that. And the international president of CORE, Charles Oldham, offered me a job as an international organizer. So I did. And he was once in my development.
I'm going to come back to the question that I normally ask as the first question after introductions. And that is, what did you have to learn? What did you have to go through in life to learn how you wanted to live your life? What did you have to experience?
Well, let me give you a very skimpy idea of my family. My dad and his sister and brother came over here to avoid the war in Italy in the turn of the century. He was born in 1890, and he was always more radical. His sister, my Aunt Noreen, was my mother, melted down her wedding ring and sent it to Mussolini when he invaded Ethiopia. My other uncle advised his son-in-law to join the FBI, which was a turning point in my life. Bob Nischwitz became an FBI agent, and he made my life. Hoover was always calling him in to find out what I was doing, and he poisoned our whole family with scurrilous rumors about how nefarious my involvement with X were. And of course, my wife, we were in New York organizing the March on Washington in the summer of 63, and worked in Newark in housing projects. And there was a sit-in at Jefferson Bank over four jobs. They were not hiring blacks in teller jobs. So my wife got arrested with a dozen other people and spent 6 months in jail. And I was on the outside organizing the protest. I was selected to go in April of 64 after the bank situation evolved. And I was selected to go and run three Freedom Houses in Chicago by the International of Corps. And I don't have it here with me, but I have a picture that Hoover put out over the Associated Press in April of 64. This is before Photoshop. A picture of me on the left looking sinister. There's 24. Gloria Richardson from Cambridge, Maryland is in the middle looking sinister at me. And then Jim Farmer, who was the head of Corps, looking straight into the camera, and he's like, Mr. Mainstream. We were designated as disruptors and leading the African-American community into dangerous paths. So that was my first public. But even before that, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in that summer, Patrick Buchanan, who later ran for president, he was the editorial writer for the Post-Dispatch, and he and a guy named Denny Welch won all kinds of awards for trying to prove that Dr. King was a communist. And even they did a number on me that I was 5 years marriage and had no children. So that's a slap on my Catholicism. But these people have no scruples whatsoever. It's just the early take on what we're going through right now with these dangerous times.
Right. So how did you survive that kind of malicious information, fake?
Well, I it rolled off my back. But my father, who had been in business with his brother for 40 years, they ran the biggest selling Budweiser in St. Louis. And when he died, the family refused to let my father ride in the hearse. Was the racism in the Italian American family was so profound that broke his heart and mine as well. And even my aunt, who had never spoke to me, she was my godmother. We never spoke again because of the scurrilous thing she said about my wife being in jail with black men.
That generation, you never really had anything more to do with.
I have one first cousin who's in her 97 who communicates with me, but all the other people I grew up with, we tons and tons of cousins, not a single one of them will have anything to do, not even a Christmas card. Or my father would see them shopping, they would shun him in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And my mother as well.
So, well, I want to jump ahead here a little bit. My guess is that there's going to be some of that kind of judgment coming down now on people
who
take positions that are contrary to the assumptions of their families. And then this probably goes in all directions because we're living in a really judgmental time.
Right. Right.
What did you learn about living with that kind of conflict in your family of origin and moving forward in your life? What did you learn about yourself and how to cope?
Just to develop a thick skin and not let it get too under your psyche, and you know, take it. Well, this is all a prelude to working with Dr. King in Chicago, where we were constantly filed by the FBI. Our phones were tapped, and of course, they did everything they could to drive him to suicide.
Right, but right.
Another story. It's a later story.
And you said to develop a thick skin and not let it get under your skin. What did that mean in day-to-day living for you? What did it mean for you to develop a thick skin?
That's a good question. I can't give you a totally precise answer other than my involvement with the black community and music has my whole life been a sustaining force. And I think it was more than compensation for losing a lot of folks who could never appreciate that and were tied up with their own psychosis.
Right. Right.
So you write them off.
Right. And you have to learn how to look at people who profess one day to love you and care about you, who now viscerally hate you.
Yes.
And not respond with the same kind of hate.
Right. No, I never did.
What kept you from responding with hate?
Well, I think involvement with Dr. King and his philosophy of Gandhianism, and, you know, love your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that had something to do with it. I can't be that precise.
Sure.
But he had a tremendous influence on me. I mean, I knew him to play basketball and shoot pool with Black Street Rangers. I don't want to get ahead of your interrogation here, but I worked for 4 years with him when he was in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
We had an interracial, interdenominational coalition that brought him in 65 to Chicago, made up of auto workers, packing house workers, all the major unions, and we raised $100,000 in Soldiers Field to bring him to Chicago. In the Episcopal Peace Fellowship, Mattie Hopkins was a central figure in that. She had gone to Mississippi after Selma, and there was something called the Chicago Committee for Human Rights that did work in Selma for people who were beaten up. And Dr. Quentin Young was the head of it in Chicago, who just died recently. But it was a really broad, the Catholic Interracial Society, the Urban League, all of these groups brought him to, and I was the, is it called the Coordinating Council of Community Organizations. And the president of it was Al Raby, and I was his executive director. And I worked mainly with unions to bring in, and I got involved with Dr. King organizing hospital workers. Private hospital workers, mm-hmm. until he was killed.
What did you learn in those years about working with people? Because you're still pretty young. You're still under 30 at that point.
Are you kidding? Oh, then. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah, back then. Yeah.
In 65, you were under 30. You were about.
Well, I think the lessons I learned were from going into these small segregated towns and meeting people in Kansas City, Kansas, and Omaha. Dr. Claude Argon was chief oncologist at Creighton University. And we would sit down with the local Baptist minister and pool hustlers and pull together, just working with people who wanted to see the right. That was a primary lesson, sleeping on people's. People always ask me, what hotel did you stay in? Well, we traveled by bus and slept on people's couches.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You just needed an available couch.
Yeah.
So you, did you ever go to St. Joe, Missouri?
St. Joe? No, I didn't.
Its African-American population was tiny in those days.
No, that was one place. I was in Independence. Mm-hmm. Truman's hometown, and but no, I never was in St. Joe.
Yep. So
but let me just touch on that, on Missouri. My father's brother, he lost his child and his first wife at an early age, and he married a woman from Marley, Missouri, which is the southern foothill of.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Was next to the FBI agent with Florida's case for me. She was spread word among the family that don't go to my parents' house. You'll never know who's sitting at the table with you. Yeah, some black person. So I had to put up with it for a long time.
Right.
But I'll tell you, my uncle, we never had any kind of political magazine at Boy's Life, but he subscribed to Reader's Digest. And on Friday, we would open eat there, and I would read it thoroughly for how to improve Boy Bar. And an article where once I read in the early 50s about Jomo Kenyatta and the Mau Mau in Kenya. And it so intrigued me that I began to research it for a paper and found out it was a British barrister, Montague Slater, who did a book on the trial. And of course, it was all framed up, and he later became president of Kenya. But that had, that particular thing had a big impact on me.
Mm-hmm. And I suspect that there was lots of pieces of evidence to get a hold of if you were curious to widen your perspective.
Yeah, I'll never forget in grade school, we were subject to really indoctrination by the Catholic diocese. When I was in the eighth grade, every Catholic high school in the city, I know it was grade school, it was my eighth grade, would go down to Kiel Auditorium to listen to Dr. Fred Schwartz in the anti-communist crusade.
Right.
And it was full of these young, bright-eyed Catholic kids. And something didn't click with me with what he was peddling for some reason. I guess I was always and then I can remember when General Eisenhower, or no, Truman fired MacArthur. His speech to the Senate was piped into every Catholic school in the Senate because the Catholics were big MacArthur fans. They thought he was going to become president. So there was that indoctrination that I was aware of.
Mm-hmm.
It just somehow didn't click in my brain.
Right. Was your first sit-in in 1958 in the Italian restaurant on the edge of the Washington University campus?
Yeah, and it was pretty benign.
Right, but what experience, you would have been 18 years old, what experience led you to take that action? What relationships, what connections, what led you to do that?
I had a couple of good friends who were African-American, and we went there to eat, and they wouldn't serve us, so we started sitting in.
And how did I'm going to say this in a very offensive way. How did a good white boy like yourself make a couple of African-American friends in 1950s St. Louis?
Rather tortuously, because when I graduated high school, St. Louis U High had a reputation for people having high grades and a lot of academic accomplishment. And I was rushed by a fraternity at Washington U called Sigma Nu. And I was in a class with a young, I can't think of the guy's name anymore, a black drummer. And they said, bring in any prospective candidates you have to join. So I brought him to the fraternity. And of course they said, this is a stupid, we don't allow blacks here. So it was a turning point where I joined a fraternity.
And you had gone to high school with him?
No.
Or how had you met him?
Trying to think. Well, he was rushing. I don't know what school, but he was rushing for fraternity at Washington U. You know, they asked you to bring somebody, and he was in a class of mine. I thought he was
sure.
A drummer. And
yeah,
jazz.
So you were into jazz when you were a teenager, or
yeah.
And that's the
a piano teacher, Mrs. Bates, who I did a lot of stride piano. I was playing Scott Joplin and that type of music.
Sure, sure. And when you talk about music being the thing that kind of helped hold you together under these trials, that's, it goes back to your teenager or earlier years.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking of giving you a song. My grandmother, who was born in Arlen County, Mayo, and migrated to, she's an au pair, had me play these songs for her. Crappy Boy, I was thinking, but I thought maybe that's a little too heavy for the show.
Sure.
Anyway, Dominic Behan sings that, by the way, Behan's brother. Just some great music.
So let's take a break from music. What would you like to play next?
Get on board, little children. Robeson.
Okay, here we go.
Get on board, little children, get on board, little children, get on board, little children, there's room for many on board. The gospel trains are coming, I hear it just at hand. Hear the car wheels rumbling and rolling through the land. Oh, get on board, little children, get on board, little children, get on board, little children, there's room for many on board. I hear the train are coming, it's coming round the curve. On its steam and brakes and straining every nerve. Oh, get on board, little children, get on board. The little children, get on board, the little children. There's room for many on board. The fare is cheap and all can go. The rich and the poor are there. No second class aboard this train, no difference in the fare. Get on board, the little children, get on board. The little children, get on board, the little children. There's room for many on board. Oh, get on. Children, get on board, little children, get on board, little children, there's room for many on board.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Gene Turnower. So Gene, your involvement in CORE, how did that shape the life that you lived in the decades afterwards?
Pretty profoundly, I think. The ability to work with any stratum of intellectual professionals and just darn hard. When my wife went to jail, of the 12 people who were in jail with her, one was a Baptist minister, the other was an alderman, the others were lawyers. So, you know, you tend to stereotype people, and there's just as much a range among them as there is among any other group of people.
Sure.
I appreciated that from an early age. One item I should have mentioned, my father sent packages to his cousins in Italy during the war. They fought against the Germans in the Alpine, up in the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
They sent clothes and money to them. And I'll never forget, we used to go hunting all the time. Right? We had beagles, and every Sunday we'd go hunting for rabbits and quail. And in the back of our garage where we kept the dogs, he had a huge photograph from a newspaper of Mussolini hanging upside down with his mistress, Claire Petacci. And of course, being Italian, they had a belt around her skirt, so she would be supposed to.
Right.
And it says a lot about his political orientation.
Sure, sure. He's
strongly anti-fascist.
Right, right. And that's one of the most gripping pictures one can imagine.
Yep.
They've been eviscerated.
Yep. Machine gun.
Pardon?
They were machine gunned. You know?
Yeah. So what kind of work did you do, and what kinds of things, where did you find, after coming out of the crucible of the 1960s, what did you find meaningful? So I'll tell you a little bit about me. I challenged the town, the people in the town that I grew up in, and I was functionally run out of town at the age of 17, 18.
Oh, really? Well,
for taking on the powers that be, and why so many people would, one out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20 because of drugs or alcohol or run-ins with the police or bad health care or all sorts of stuff, suicides and all sorts of stuff. And I just took it on. But the local physician would confirm privately everything that I had challenged, but he wouldn't do so publicly. So I was pretty much by myself at that point. And
that's kind of my experience.
Yeah. So how did you find your feet to live a full life after you've been through a crucible like what you were through?
I don't know if I really have yet, to be totally honest. It's
right. You don't. Yeah, you don't know whether you really did or not. But what did you do?
Well, I always had a lot of jobs going to college. I once taught Latin to a Jewish family. The little girl needed Latin tutoring. And as a consequence, I was brought into their family and just was amazed the amount of food and the warmth that they had for me as a tutor. Mm-hmm. But the woman, Rosalind Greenbaum, had been very active in the ADA, which is a political group. She was friends with Harold Gibbons, who was one of the Teamsters in St. Louis. And I used to meet Gibbons at her house. We became friends. So when King was killed, I moved to New York and got a job through Harold with the Teamster local, Silverman family. And it was members in Connecticut, Jersey, and I was the organizing director. I did the publications. In fact, I put out a leaflet once in Polish with Pope John's endorsing trade unions out in Long Island for women in their 80s standing on a concrete floor organized, getting tulip bulbs. But there was a Jesuit priest a block away at St. Francis Xavier's school who hated the Teamsters' corruption. And I would go visit him. He'd say, same question you just asked. How did a decent young Jesuit trained person get involved with this mob family? But we organized. You know, I'm not trying to put lipstick on a pig. There were tough people organizing, and we did. We brought home the bacon for people who had no representation. So I could live with it.
Right.
Well, that's another story. When Ron Kerry was elected, he trusted the local and brought in a mobster from Rhode Island, Joe Petalero, who took over the local and got rid of me.
And what?
He fired me.
Right.
Because I wouldn't do his bidding.
Right, right. So
that's another story. And after I left the Teamsters, 95, Bill Moriarty, who was a friend of mine from St. Louis, a trumpet player, was head of the 802 Musicians Local, and he hired me to work as an organizer for the American Federation of Musicians, which I've done for 20 years now. Uh-huh. I used to come up here and help negotiate a contract with the Binghamton Symphony and Glimmer Glass, and know this area up here pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. But what I notice is that when you are fighting for a cause, you don't always get to be with or against people who are purely one way or the other, as it were, in terms of, and you're choosing to put yourself in a conflicted situation.
Absolutely. I don't know of any other way to put it, but anyway, it's very... My mother used to say that's called fancy dancing.
Right, right. And how, so what about your upbringing or the things you ran into taught you to accept the moral complexity rather than simply rail against it?
I think from an early age in grade school, I mentioned this earlier. We were given a demographic map in the eighth grade of tuberculosis in St. Louis. And I had another schematic of the Black community. And if you put that over it, it decided exactly where the most tuberculosis cases were in the African American community. Those things really struck me. I did a lot of reading. I read Henry Box's Black person who put himself in a box and mailed himself I really got into that history at an early age.
As the old saying goes, you can see a lot if you look.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
But what? So some people who see a lot just are inherently curious, and some people who see a lot were so thoroughly astounded by something they stumbled upon that they didn't expect to see that their lives were changed.
Well, let me tell you one story. Sure. My uncle, my mother was one of five kids. Her brother, Charles Anderson, by the way, went down on the Arizona with an aircraft and he survived. And he then
In Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, the ship. Yeah, he survived that. But then he went to work for Howard Hughes in security. And I'll never forget, you talk about a photo grasping your brain. 1955, I was riding in a car with him, and I had just seen pictures of Emmett Till, the face, if you recall what that horrible picture was.
Yeah.
I said to him, isn't this a tragic 14-year-old boy? And he's a nigger lover. So that really broke any respect I had sort of went out.
Yeah. He burned you away. Yeah. And you were about the same age as Emmett Till.
Yeah. My aunt, who had been a nun, used to visit us every summer. Her husband was a sewer inspector for Mary Daly in Chicago. They lived on the north side in Patty Bowler's ward. And he would go to work at 11 and get home at 2 as a sewer inspector, except for election time. Everybody, we'd all come to Chicago and work like a dog to get down to vote for Patty Bowler. But she was racist too. She went to my library and had my mother even ask. She called a local priest to look at what I was reading. And my mother threw the window in. So it was some sort of a support mechanism there.
Right.
She was very racist.
What about your mother made it possible for her to bar the priest from your house and from censoring?
I just because she trusted me, I guess. I don't know. She never intruded at all. You know, she loved her brothers and sisters, but there was a line that she allowed them to interfere.
But she protected you.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
And what, I mean, there's a mama bear protection, but there's also a mama bear with purpose.
Yeah.
And how did your life, in some sense, further her purpose?
Well, I think she was always, she had worked for a really rich, she left high school at 15, was a telephone operator. And then she became an au pair for a very rich family in St. Louis. And breaking away, they really insisted that she not get married. They told my father was Italian. He said, if you break up with him, he's going to kill you.
So, if you what?
If you break up with him, he'll murder you. She married him anyway. But she really was a decent, just, she would speak to anybody. There was never any ounce of, we used to have guys come around in the back door and ask for sandwiches, and she would always give people something to eat. So there was.
She had a tough compassion, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she doesn't seem scared.
No. No, she put with a lot of, I think it hurt her tremendously when my dad was cut off from his family. And of course they cut off too. They would walk by their house on Sunday and turn their head away, not look at them. Because they live right next to each other.
Yeah. Like all the old ethnic families, they took over a block.
Yeah. But to get back to the question you asked, you know, I knew Dr. King shooting basketball and playing pool, and then I would see him at the University of Chicago Theological School carrying on high caliber debates with the theologians, Paul Tillich and others. I mean, he was comfortable in any kind of milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, once we did a demonstration, we took rats. It was an anti-slum campaign. It was called the Urban Training Center for Urban Mission, and the later became the head of Cathedral St. John. Jim Morton ran that for years with Archie Harker. Major figures in the world would bring ministers in from all over denominations and spend a week with $15 and told to arrive in Chicago. Really quite a telling experience. So anyway, we collected all these rats and put them up on the cross bars of broken steel banisters and walked into City Hall one day with all these and let the rats loose in City Hall. And that, that caused quite a Mayor Daley was not happy with that action.
So what happened after the King assassination? How did you recover, or how did you move on from that?
Well, it's kind of fortuitous. The building we were at on the corner of North and Wells was subject for demolition. They were widening the street, so they paid our transportation to come to New York and load up everything. And that's what I mentioned to you before. We used to go to Plug Nickel and hear Mose Allison for $5 and a beer in the Rush Street area. And I worked with the hospital organizing campaign with some really terrific people from Crowley, who was a James Joyce scholar, who went to Mississippi with his pregnant wife in 65. He was one of the organizers. He's just recently died. And Rennie Davis, who just died from the Chicago 7, used to come and visit me because he had a group called the Jesse James Gangs, or White Appalachians. Some of them came and joined us, and we let the rats go. But Rennie was, well, if you see that movie, it's not totally fair to him, but he's, anyway, he just passed away.
So let's cut to music, and then we're going to come back for another segment of the show before we call it a day. What should we play next?
Ethel Waters, Eye on a Sparrow.
So why should I feel discouraged? Or why should the shadows come? Why should my heart be lonely away from heaven and home? When Jesus is my portion, my constant friend is He. For His eye is on the sparrow, and I know He watches me. that he watches. We
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Gene Turnower. So Gene, the way I usually close out this show is with a question about your own self-care. How do you take care of yourself physically, emotionally, and intellectually? And you've had a long life, and you've done some really courageous things in the course of that life, but how have you learned to take care of yourself? So you mentioned some before, but physically, emotionally, and intellectually?
Not very carefully. I have not paid enough attention to, although my kids are constantly on me. I have two daughters and a son. In fact, I have a COVID test coming up in Syracuse in a couple weeks, but they do a lot of supervision. It's called assisted living, I think.
Or so, assisted or pushed along, one or the other.
I'm not really used to being maneuvered, so to speak. They're great kids, and they've all turned out.
Did you raise them all in New York City?
Yeah, our building was next door to Nicky Barnes, the great drug king of Manhattan. Those three brownstones he owned. He was major in the intersection of the Cross Bronx and the GW. He was the kingpin of drug dealers. And all the kids, half of Gino's friends are either jail or dead.
Right.
And he survived.
But your kids managed to stay clear of that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's touch and go, you know. Life is a crapshoot, so to speak.
Right, to some extent, yeah. How did you make relationships for your kids when your family of origin was no longer available to you?
My mother, every summer, they would spend a month or more with her in St. Louis. She has, after my dad retired, they had a few acres, and he had a truck farm where he grew. And that really helped save them, because she would take them to church and put white clothes and patent leather shoes on. Any religion they had was for my mother. I think she really baptized them too. We're speculating about that.
Right, right.
But they had a tremendous impact on her, all three kids, or she had on them rather.
And when did you stop serving as a rep with the music union?
In July of 19, just a year ago.
Okay.
I had all the symphonies and juke joints all over the north, you know, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Massachusetts. And I used to travel around a lot until I got more difficulty.
And what about that life do you miss the most right now?
Oh, the musicians. The best people that I've ever encountered who just eking out, it's called a gig economy.
Right.
They have, you know, the symphony players are different. They have contract protection, medical coverage. But the average Joe in these, you know, you play for the door and they're just not making it. I get calls all the time of how he's trying to survive. I don't have much to offer.
Right. So as we come around, I'm going to change subjects just a little bit here. As we come around to another, I don't know if it's going to be an era or a few years or a longer haul of activism and open conflict in this country, what advice about self-care would you give to people who are going to be heading into highly conflicted situations? What would you encourage them to do to take better care of themselves, to be ready to fight the next day or to struggle the next day?
Yeah, be more attentive to your health issues, which I never seriously faced. My sister was a nurse, and she was constantly giving me advice as to my creatinine level and all the measurements that you're supposed to be
aware to.
And I miss her a lot.
Right.
Very conscientious. She was 40 years as a floor leading nurse at Cardinal Glennon Hospital in St. Louis for children.
Wow. Wow.
So it says something about her upbringing.
Right, right.
You know, I can't really stop without giving a plug for Jesuit education.
For what?
Jesuit education in my high school.
Sure.
I studied Latin and Greek in the original. 4 years of Latin, 2 years of Greek. Chaucer in the original. And I can't speak highly enough of their the influence that's had on my whole life of it. Even debating
right.
learn how to do in high school.
So the rigorous engagement of language and ideas.
Right, right.
Gene, it's been wonderful to get to know you a little bit.
Well, thank you. I'm not the greatest. My neck is bothering me, but I thought I better.
No, thank you, thank you. What song would you like to close the show with today?
I'm trying to think of the artist who sang Mississippi Goddamn.
Nina Simone.
Simone, if you could play that, it sort of captures a little bit of my concerns.
Thank you, Gene.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
You love, and of course, a couple of years ago, four little girls were killed in Alabama. And at that time, we got the inspiration to do this song. But Dr. King's murder has left me so numb, I don't know where I'm at, really. And of course you heard this song that was composed by Gene Taylor, especially for today. But I hope that between now and the end of the year, it'll all be together enough that we will have songs that go down in history for these wonderful, brave people who are no longer with us. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurline Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Hound dogs on my trail. Little school children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path. I think every day's gonna be my last.
time, 'cause I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you, me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. You keep on saying go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Washing the windows, picking the cotton, nothing but rotten. Too damn lazy, thinking's crazy. Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know. I don't know. Just try to do my very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest, 'cause everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Now you heard him. He's one of you. If you have been moved at all, and you know my songs at all, for God's sakes, join me. Don't sit back there. The time is too late now. Good God. You know, the king is dead. The king of love is dead. I ain't about to be nonviolent, honey. Oh, no. Picket lines, school boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot, but all I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. And I loved him because he believed it. He lived by it. But you lied to me all the years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you stopped calling my mama Aunt Sadie. Hear me now. But my country is full of lies. We all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust nobody anymore. Keep on saying go slow. That's just the trouble. Desegregation. Mass participation. Unification. Do things gradually. Next to me, just give me my equality.